You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Paul Christensen. Paul, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Paul, let's talk about what you're working on now. What are you currently involved in to begin with? If it's more than one thing, let's hear them all.
Well, one big project is consuming most of my time and energy. It's a project that actually has a title, The Oxford History of the Archaic Greek World, which will consist of studies of 30 different places, sites, regions, sanctuaries in the Greek world in the Archaic period, which is to say about 800 to about 450 BC. And it's a big scale project. I'm co-directing it with Paul Cartledge, who's in Cambridge University in the UK, but we're writing only about 10% of it, and we're co-editing the rest of it, and the whole project, when it's done, will run to about a million words, give or take.
Wow, that's a huge project. So How did that project start? What was the genesis of that? I mean, I'd like to get into more details, but yeah, how did it begin?
Sure. Yeah, so Oxford University Press came to me in 2012 and said they wanted me to edit the Oxford Companion to the Archaic Greek World. And companions are sort of a big scholarly industry right now. So there's the Companion to Shakespeare and the Companion to Sophocles. And the idea is it provides a series of articles that offer an introduction to some particular subject, typically sort of aimed at an undergraduate audience. So they asked me to do that, and I was not very excited about that prospect, primarily because there were already two companions to Archaic Greece by other publishers, and it didn't seem like another one was going to be terribly useful. So I made a counterproposal to them, which was that we would be much better served by doing something that offered studies of individual cities in the Archaic period. And the reason for that is the Greeks were, in the context of other ancient cultures, very unusual in the sense that they were broadly geographically dispersed. So most pre-modern cultures tended to be in one place. So if you think, for example, the ancient Egyptians, most of them lived near the River Nile. And so you could draw a map where most people who had come under the heading of Egyptian lived, and just draw a circle around them, it was a small contiguous territory, or reasonably large contiguous territory. The Greeks were completely different in that sense. So the Greek homeland has always been exactly where it is now, on the southern end of the Balkan Peninsula. But starting around 750 BC, give or take, the Greeks started founding trading posts and colonies all over the Mediterranean basin. So they were settled in what's now Spain, what's now southern France. So, for example, the French town of Marseille started off as a Greek colony, Massalia, and they were settled in southern Italy, in Sicily, North Africa, all over the coast of what's now Turkey, the north shore of the Black Sea. Pretty much anywhere they could get to by boat, they went to and settled down. And so they were dispersed over an immense stretch of territory, which was non-contiguous. Right, and that made them unusual. And the other thing is that they tended to immigrate mostly in groups of young men. And so when they got to wherever they were settling, they by necessity intermarried with the local indigenous population. So all these Greek sites, every one had its own specific history. So the Greeks in southern France intermarry with the Celts, and the Greeks in southern Russia intermarry with the Scythians. And so Greek communities throw enormous diversity across the space of the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. Now, that presents huge challenges for us, right? Because the question is, how do you generalize over that much territory with so many people and so much doing so many different things? And there is some grounds for generalization because the Greeks themselves felt like they belonged to a single ethnic group, even though they were widely dispersed. And that's why things like the Olympics were so important for them. The Olympics were sort of a celebration of Greek identity. Greeks from all over the Mediterranean came in to participate and to watch them, and was a place to go for Greeks to come sort of renew their sense of Greekness. And if you think about when the Greeks settled in Egypt starting in the 4th century BC, in some numbers, one of the first things they did was to build a big Greek cultural institution, the Museum of Alexandria, the idea being to sort of maintain and spread Greek culture and make certain that the Greeks in Egypt maintain their identity. So there is some grounds for saying the Greeks have a lot of things in common, but they also were a very diverse group. And this has presented big challenges for archaeologists and historians because it's a lot of information to try to figure out. And so what we have done traditionally is to look at two cities in some detail, Athens and Sparta, and to generalize broadly on the basis of Athens and Sparta. And when people ask me about this project, I always tell them so. I say, imagine that I was going to write a history of the United States in the year 2017, and it's 2,000 years from now. It's 4017, and I'm looking backwards to the United States of our day, 2017. And I know a lot about New York and a lot about Los Angeles, and I write a book about the United States. Well, some of the book's going to be okay, right? Some of the book's going to be right on. Some of the book's going to be a total disaster because Texas is very different than New York or Los Angeles in some ways. And so Greek historians and archaeologists have been in that sort of position, which is that we know there's a lot of diversity, but we mostly extrapolate on the basis of Athens and Sparta. Okay. Now, the question is, can we do better? And the answer is, absolutely. We know a lot about a lot of Greek communities. A lot of them have been excavated for decades. The problem is that the information is scattered among literally thousands of different publications. So, for example, the Greeks settled in what's now Libya in a big community called Cyrene. And the Cyrene has been dug over generations, mostly by Italian scholars. And I could learn a lot about Cyrene if I wanted to sit down and run down all the different publications and read them all. But it would probably take me a year or maybe 2 years to get all that information together. But the problem is there were 1,000 separate autonomous Greek communities. I couldn't possibly begin to scratch the surface. So what I proposed to Oxford was, listen, if we put together a geographical cross-section of sites that have been well excavated, and they were all written up in the same format, so every entry had a section for political history of that site, for its diplomatic history, for its political systems, for its economic system, I could sit down and just read everything I always wanted to know about Cyrene in the space of about 40 or 50 pages. Or I could read about the political systems of 30 different Greek communities in the space of a day. And that would be incredibly transformative in terms of people being able to understand what's the same and what's different across the Greek world in a particular period of time.
Right.
So that was the design of the project. It was in part inspired by a book written by Paul Cartledge called A History of Greece in 11 Cities, which was a relatively short book, and he just sort of picked one city per period in sort of different periods of Greek history looking at a city. And so I went to Paul Cartledge, whom I had met before, is a very eminent Greek historian, and after some doing, I persuaded him that this would be a great project for him to collaborate on. So we went out, and the big issue, of course, is who's going to write the entries, right? So we pick sites, and we want the person or people who have been working on those sites for a long period of time, who know them the best, to write for us. And there was some good fortune there and some good planning, so we got an extraordinarily eminent group of historians to cooperate and collaborate with us. And so those studies were commissioned in 2014 for the most part, and about half of them have come in, and so we're editing and doing some writing. And I am learning a huge amount about all these sites I've heard about but never actually knew very much about.
I bet you are, just through the editing process and your own work. So maybe we should talk about one of those things. I'd love to hear some of the things that you've discovered or that you never knew before about some of these parts. It could be either through what you're editing or what you're writing, but it sounds really just kind of still almost monumental in its size, right? It's just huge what you're trying to cover.
Yes, so absolutely. There are days there are days when I am excited because I know that when it's done, it's going to be this really incredibly useful resource. And in some sense, it's, you know, it's a way of leaving one's mark on the profession and making a contribution is to give people this resource. And there are days I think, this is just crazy. This is a bad decision. Because no matter how hard I work and how many hours I work, it's hard to move the needle any given week on that kind of project. And
right.
I was in Cambridge last year, and I was there for the whole year working on this project. And at the end of the year, we had made some progress, but not a huge amount of progress. And I was feeling sort of discouraged. And I was at this party with a bunch of Cambridge academics, and I was talking to one of them, and he asked me about the project. And he said, and I didn't tell him I was feeling discouraged, but he must have sort of gotten that sense from me. He sort of patted me on the back, and he said, "Listen, this is a once-in-a-generation project. It's not going to happen again. No one else is going to do it. So, you just have to think about if it's a once-in-a-generation project, it's going to take, it's going to take 10 years. And that's okay. That's what makes it that scale project. That's the only way to get there." So I hold on to that little... that little nugget of, encouragement when I feel like we're sort of treading water sometimes. But the other thing is that it's been a huge treat for me to read the entries. So, for example, there was a Greek colony in southern Italy called Metapontion, the Americans had been spent a lot of time there digging with the Italians, but I never really understood much about it because, again, there's just a huge amount of publication material. So the American archaeologist, a guy named Joseph Carter, was at the University of Texas, who's been digging there for, 20 or 30 years, wrote the entry for us for Metapontion. And one of the things that came out of Metapontion is they did a lot of pollen cores, which is to say they could tell what was growing in what parts of the territory when. And so it was just fascinating to see that sort of analysis, which just hasn't been done anywhere else. And I just read the entry for the island of Eubea a couple of weeks ago, and there's a very complicated relationship between two cities, and I never really understood how that relationship had evolved, and now I do because the people who wrote that did such a great job of creating clarity out of a really complicated situation because they know the evidence so well. So just reading this stuff has been an enormous help. And then Paul Cartledge and I are writing the entry for Sparta.
And so how's that coming along? Should we talk a little about that before we go? Because Sparta, I imagine that's quite a huge amount of information.
Yeah, and that's been a really fascinating experience too, I have to say. So Paul Cartledge is one of the sort of two sort of most eminent historians of Sparta, and he's done a lot of really great work. He hasn't published much on Sparta in the last 10 or 15 years because he's been very busy with other things, but he was interested in coming back, and I had written some history of Sparta, but never had looked very carefully at its material culture. So we started working on the project, and the thing that really I found most fascinating was that Sparta has a very weird excavation history. So, for instance, Athens has been dug continuously. So there's been archaeologists poking around all over the city of modern Athens since the 19th century every year. But Sparta's had a very different excavation history. The British dug there for 8 years in the early part of the 20th century. And since then, there has been very little systematic excavation. The Greek archaeologists who work for the Greek Archaeological Service, the government archaeological service, have done some occasional rescue excavations, but most of the city of ancient Sparta remained untouched. So we really didn't know much about it. And that actually all changed in 1995 for a particular reason, which is the way it works in Greece is that some areas are declared archaeologically protected zones of the sort of top flight kind, which means that nothing can be built on it. It's non-buildable, and typically it's owned by the government. And then there's some land which there's no archaeological protection on. If you're the owner, you can do whatever you want. But there's an intermediate category where the government says, it's your land, you can do what you want within limits, but before you do anything, you have to have the Greek Archaeological Service come in and look at the property to make certain that you're not destroying something valuable. So
right.
Most of the city of ancient Sparta had no archaeological protection up through 1995.
Wow.
Which meant that it just had never been dug. No one, it was just a big blank spot on the map. No one knew. The modern city was built right on top of the ancient city on purpose, and no one knew what was there. So the archaeologists in the archaeology service in Greece had protested about this for generations, that this had to be changed, that the city had to be protected. And so that protection finally came through in 1995, which meant that anytime someone started wanting to build something in the modern city of Sparta, the Greek Archaeological Service came in and dug a hole to look at it. And suddenly in 1995, all these, they're called rescue excavations because they're short excavations, but they are all digging holes all over Sparta for the first time. And suddenly they started finding all sorts of things. So for example, up through 1995, all the whole period of Spartan history before the Roman period, they had found no cemeteries at all. It was very unclear where the Spartans buried anyone. And then as soon as they extended the archaeological protection, literally a few weeks later, they found the first cemetery. So there's been an enormous mass of archaeological information coming out of the ground in Sparta all of a sudden. And so Paul Cartledge and I spent much of the last year just catching up on all that material and starting to consolidate it and to begin to sort of use it to put it together in a systematic way so we can write a narrative. So one thing, for example, which has come out of that, which is really interesting if you're a Sparta person or a Greek historian or archaeologist, which is the standard thinking had always been that in all Greek communities after about 750 BC, any adult who died was buried outside the walls of the city, that there was no burial for adults inside the city because it was considered to pollute the living space. And the idea was that the only exception to that rule was the Spartans, that the Spartans buried their dead inside the city. Well, so when they started excavating Sparta for the first time, it turned out that Spartans were burying their dead both inside the city and outside the city at the same time. So the question is, what does that mean exactly? Well, so there's been work going on in some of the cities near Sparta, like Argos and Corinth, and it turns out that Sparta, that pattern of people being buried both inside the city and outside the city after 750 BC holds true not just for Sparta, but for places like Argos and Corinth as well. So the Spartans had always been seen as these strange outliers in Greek burial practice, but now it turns out that they are completely typical, that they were burying their dead exactly the same way as their neighbors were burying their dead. And the weirdos, it turns out the people who are the outliers are the Athenians. The Athenians are doing something which is entirely unusual, and it's the Spartans who are completely typical.
Huh, fascinating. So this is very new, of course, because of, as you're describing, all the excavations in Sparta. This is all such new information.
Absolutely. If you talk to the average Greek archaeologist on the street and tell them that there is what we call an extramural cemetery, a cemetery outside the walls for Sparta before the Roman period, most of them don't know it exists yet because the publications are so new. They tend to be scattered all over the place, and most of them in modern Greek, so they're a little hard to access. So I've been giving some talks about this here and there, and people sit up in their chairs when I stand up and say, so let me tell you about the cemetery in Sparta. And people sit up in their chairs because they say, what cemetery? There is no cemetery. The Spartans didn't have an extramural cemetery. And I say, actually, they did.
So
there's a lot of stuff going on like that. We have a lot of new material. So.
Yeah, that's really pretty thrilling. And when will this come out? Do you have any idea when it will be finished?
Well, yeah, it depends on what day you get me. I think that it depends upon how quickly we progress through the editorial process and how quickly it goes through the copy editing process. I think we're sort of shooting for about 3 years from now, something like that. Things may appear, there's 30 different studies, so some of them may appear, they don't all have to appear at the same time, so some of them may come out in sequence one at a time as we go. We'll see how that works out.
Well, that is an exciting project, and I'm glad we got to talk about it at this stage. Very, very fascinating what's coming out of that. Before we go, I want to ask what you're reading on now, which is off topic, or might be off topic, or probably not, but what is it that you're reading at the moment?
So, you know, it's going to sound like my life is really boring, which I may well be. So I was trained as an historian, which means I use mostly texts. And so for this project, it really was important for me to get much more serious about reading the archaeological material and understanding it and using it. And that's actually where I started. I started off on that end of the profession and then became an historian. So in some ways, it's going back to my roots. But one of the things which has changed seriously in the last 10 or 15 years is the ability to map things using GIS, geographic information systems. And that can be hugely helpful in plotting things. So, for example, in looking at the burials in Sparta, putting them all on a terrain map so you can see not just where they were in two dimensions, but where they were in three dimensions. So, for instance, the burials inside the city of Sparta are either alongside roads or on the slopes of low hills. And in a two-dimensional projection, that's hard to see. But in a three-dimensional projection, it becomes much more apparent where the graves were going. So geographic information systems are hugely helpful for that, but that is very far from my area of expertise. So I've been sitting around in the evenings reading an introductory book on geographic information systems.
Well, that is kind of fascinating because that is a whole new way of looking at the world. Isn't that the way I've seen probably videos on the mapping of Angkor Wat or other places that previously couldn't be so easily determined in terms of the vastness of what they're covering?
Sure. And that works at all scales. One of the things that's really happened just in the last few years is photogrammetry, which means you take pictures and the computer assembles a three-dimensional model, has made life much easier for archaeologists. So when archaeologists would dig things up, they would have to sketch them and measure them very carefully. But now with a quite reasonably priced digital camera, if you give it a scale and you take some pictures of it and feed the pictures into a computer, it generates a three-dimensional model for you to scale. And so this has been a miracle for the archaeologists because they can document objects in a matter of 2 minutes, and the computer handles something that would have taken them 2 weeks of drawing just 5 or 10 years ago. So at both that level and then at the larger macro level of taking very detailed maps based upon aerial photography and satellite photography and developing terrain models and putting the objects into the terrain model has been a huge help for them too. So I'm just trying to get up to speed on what they're doing because that field is moving so quickly and has so much potential. It's fascinating to see how they're doing.
Paul, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure learning about your epic project. And
Well, it's been a real treat. The only thing I always try to emphasize to people is that, one, I couldn't do this without Paul Cartledge, who's just been a huge, invaluable help in every way, shape, and form. And the other is that the contributors have been just spectacular, that Paul and I are doing the editing, but the heavy lifting ultimately is done by the people who have been digging at these sites for much of their professional careers and who have taken the time out from that work to try to bring that into a project which makes it easier to contextualize everything. So our gratitude for the contributors knows no bounds because they have just been fantastic in making this thing possible.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate talking with you about that and to all the contributors as well.
Thanks.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.